Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to welcome you this evening to the third of the series of lectures on the world of 2000. The series is sponsored by Macmillan and the Foreign Policy Center, and Macmillan has asked me to remind you that there is a bookstall outside, and after the lecture you can buy the books there at a 20% discount. I'm delighted to be chairing this session and to be able to introduce to you Fred Halliday, who I'm sure actually needs no introduction. He's a colleague and an old friend of mine, a colleague in the Department of International Relations. He's going to be talking this evening about culture, ideology, and nationalism, a subject that is absolutely vital to the future of the international political system, and certainly given that we're told that there is a clash of civilizations, that we were told that the end of ideology had already occurred, and yet it seems to recreate itself all the time. We look forward to Fred telling us what role it plays in the world at 2000. Fred.
Thank you, Margot, for that kind introduction, and thank you all for being here on this beautiful evening. I'd like to begin by thanking the sponsors of these lectures, the Macmillan's publishers, the Foreign Policy Center, and the LSE Spanning the Centuries series for arranging this set of lectures and for encouraging me in what is undoubtedly a foolhardy venture of trying to prepare and deliver them. The purpose, just to repeat briefly for those of you who haven't been here before, the purpose of these lectures is to take a look at the international system at the turn of the millennium and to assess within a very broad remit, the remit of international relations, some of the more salient trends. And I tried in the first lecture to look at some of the broad challenges facing the international system, including war and economic instability. And in the second, I addressed what I think is, and I think the discussion showed to be, thanks to Isaac, among others, where are you, Isaac, one of the most controversial and often under-discussed features of the contemporary world, namely the United States, and how do we think about it. And here I want to look again in a broad context at a third theme, that is of ideologies and systems of belief in the contemporary international system, systems of belief about community, about society, and about how the international system is divided up. And as with so many of the topics which characterize discussion of the contemporary world, particularly in terms of the discussion on globalization, my disagreement isn't so much with those who say it's important, but with those who, on the one hand, overstate its historical novelty. I think we have to give this historical depth in order to assess what is new, but also in this case, to look at it historically in order to get out of the trap, and I think it is a trap, of seeing the past as determining the present. If I could use a slightly polemical phrase, I think we've seen far too much fault line babble, along with other forms of babble, in recent years, as if fault lines determine conflict and determine the way in which societies are divided up as well as conflict with each other. And I'm skeptical about the degree to which this is in fact the case. Now, culture is notoriously one of the most difficult of all the terms in the social sciences, including in international relations. And I think in the contemporary world, it's very difficult to get a handle on it. In one sense, one might attempt to do a global survey of world culture, rather akin to the military strategic survey or the economic world development report put out by the World Bank. And a brief look at the state of culture in the world today would suggest that there is great vitality, great change, and really no great problem at all. We have a world of over 10,000 spoken languages. We used to think there were 4,000 until some colleagues at SOAS did a survey and discovered 10,000. We have a great increase in book publication. When I was working in publishing in the early 70s, about 30,000 new books a year were published in this country alone. Now it's over 100,000, and I'm sure this is true in many other countries. We have an efflorescence of newspapers. We have, in the modern and electronic forms, all sorts of communication and distribution which were not conceivable before. The means of communication of the global media and all that is associated with them are growing in reach as new technologies come to the fore. Yet we already have a serious problem here, and the problem is, as in the contemporary world economy, a high degree of oligarchy, a high degree of control by a few. We see this in the world of publishing, where the range of diversity is getting less and less. We see it in the field of global communications, where a few global communications companies, now classified as the entertainment industry, define very much of the news which is about, and we see it in other fields as well. Now, how does this relate to the world of the millennium, and indeed, how does it relate to anything as short-term as the current context in which we are situated? When I began to think about this series of lectures, I thought of trying to organize them around the three time frames of the French historical school, the Annales school, and applying this threefold distinction to the contemporary world. As you will know, the Annales school divided time up into three strands or three forms of time. There was that of immediate events, the so-called événementiel. There was the world of long-term change, often over centuries, that of the longue durée. And then there was the intermediate world, perhaps the world of changes over decades or over generations, the conjunctural world and the conjunctural time frame. So I think that if newspaper headlines and inflation trends or other economic trends constitute the first world and time frame, that of the événementiel, and other long-term issues, perhaps global urbanization trends or shifts in gender relations, very slow to change, I'm afraid, constitute the third, the longue durée, then I would situate cultural change and cultural issues in the second, that is, in the conjunctural. So what we're discussing this evening are not immediate events, not processes that take centuries, but conjunctural changes, conjunctural issues. But I do think that the world and the world we live in is as much shaped by these conjunctural issues as it is by the more immediate, the événementiel, and by the longue durée. And for that reason alone, it's important for us to try and get a handle on it. Now, if we turn to the realm of international relations and of the international system at the turn of the millennium, as Margot Light said in her introduction, this topic is seen to be one of great importance. First of all, culture in a broad sense of values, community, identity, is said by many people in the academic world and in the public policy world to be more important than it used to be for relations between states and peoples. We hear, for example, that with the collapse of major ideologies of left and right, that nationalism has become the dominant prevailing ideology in the world today, either as an ideology of protest and of secession, but also in more powerful countries, in the USA, in Germany, in Russia, and increasingly here, for example, in the migration debate, as one that is associated with more developed and settled countries. Secondly, we hear that international relations themselves are becoming more and more dominated by cultural conflict. In particular, as Margot said, in the phrase which Huntington has popularized of a clash of civilizations. Huntington's argument being that the world will increasingly be constituted by cultural blocs which will conflict with each other, and that this will be the basis, as empires were in the past or as ideologies were in the Cold War, of international disputes. But in many ways, Huntington starts from a quite different premise, which is the premise of anarchy, when he says that there's going to be conflict and we're going to have to explain it. And he says, if not culture, then what, is part of his argument. So one has to address that side of his claim as well. The interesting thing about Huntington, as I've noted, is that nationalists and fundamentalists the world over love him. They love him in Saudi Arabia, they love him in India, they love him in Japan, I mean, in those sectors who are sympathetic to his argument. But of the theses that have dominated the discussion of international relations since the end of the Cold War and through the millennium, this is obviously one of the most influential. Thirdly, in the discussion of globalization, we read, for example, in the work of David Held and others, how the impact of culture and the interaction of cultures is one of the processes that is central to globalization, parallel to the exchange of goods and services and investment funds that lie at the core of globalization as an economic process. Indeed, one of the most challenging questions in globalization is that of assessing in what way this spread of ideas leads to greater unification, greater homogenization of cultures, to the McDonaldization of the world or whatever it may be, or how much to greater diversity through fragmentation, through new forms of creativity, or through rejection of the dominant. My own argument in the first lecture about the creation of what I term a global paranoia in the form of rejection of globalization, suggests that culture will be, and already is indeed, as much a site of conflict as of cooperation. But while all these international trends, the role of nationalism, the clash of civilizations, the role of culture and globalization, command our attention, this debate about culture is, of course, matched in discussion of domestic politics and of domestic society, where here, too, terms such as identity, community, roots, tradition, have become much more important and, in the eyes of many people, much more legitimate. Now, underlying all these questions, which are broadly ones of assessment, where's the world going, how important are these things in explaining the politics and international relations, we have ethical issues. And we have a debate which you could characterize crudely as one in which there are those who advocate the importance of this diversity and the need to respect it and take it as a starting point, people variously described as communitarians or relativists or nationalists or in some cases anti-foundationalists, those who challenge, in other words, the primacy of universal values or of any rational attempt to arrive at it, on the one hand, and those broadly termed universalists who hold to a different aspiration, one in which, while there is diversity of cultural forms and of values, and indeed of the legal and political norms associated with them, there are, and there should be, certain underlying legal and ethical principles. And I think in any discussion of the empirical, explanatory dimensions of this issue, the normative issues inevitably come in and overshadow part of the debate, though they could, I think, in traditional mode, be kept separate. Well, these are some of the issues I'd like to address in this lecture. I think they are, in other words, part of how we assess the world at 2000, even if they are not always the issues that most grab the Evan Montiel headlines. Now, the broad argument I want to make is a skeptical one, and I want to offer a view of the international system today that recognizes the importance of these phenomena, but which argues that we have perhaps lowered the threshold of plausibility. I think we need to raise the threshold of plausibility in terms of saying, how far do these things really explain either politics and change within countries or, pertinent to this lecture, international relations? It's easy to make broad generalizations about culture and postmodernity and cultural globalization and the millennial turn. One's got to say, wait a minute, what's going on here? To what extent does this really explain what is happening? To what extent can we make this claim, for example, given that nobody in the world, or virtually nobody in the world, now believes in what used to be a central part of the nationalist agenda, which is economic autarky, when everybody wants to be part of the international system and in various ways to participate in it? To what extent can we or should we accept claims about culture, identity, community, purity, or whatever it is, when in fact these are, if not invented, then at least selected? I think that there may well be a place for these things in the analysis of how the world operates, but I do think we have lowered the threshold too far. Much of what one reads is, in my view, rather mediocre history, perhaps mediocre sociology, not very good international relations. Too much of it is, as I've said, what I would call fault line babble. And the more traditional concerns which underlie these things, not least those of power and interest, seem sometimes to be left behind. Well, let me start with where I think the discussion should start and is too often not started, which is with the sociology of knowledge. In other words, the question of how do these ideas come about, how are they formed, and how are they reproduced. I want to quote from one of my favorite works of social science, one that had a great impact on me when I read it as a master's student, published in 1966, Barrington Moore's The Social Origins of Dictatorship and Democracy. And in a concluding appendix at the end of the book, he writes as follows. He says, culture or tradition is not something that exists outside of or independently of individual human beings living together in society. Cultural values do not descend from heaven to influence the course of history. To explain behavior in terms of cultural values is to engage in circular reasoning. The assumption of inertia that cultural and social continuity do not require explanation obliterates the fact that both have to be recreated anew in each generation, often with great pain and suffering. To maintain and transmit a value system, human beings are punched, bullied, sent to jail, thrown into concentration camps, cajoled, bribed, made into heroes, encouraged to read newspapers, stood up against the wall and shot, and sometimes even taught sociology, to which one could add international relations. To speak of cultural inertia is to overlook the concrete interests and privileges that are served by indoctrination, education, and the entire complicated process of transmitting culture from one generation to the other. And if that was true in an age of books and writing with quills, it's equally true in an age of the internet, the World Wide Web, and all the electronic gadgets that we now have. Barrington Moore therefore invites us to ask at least two questions. First of all, to ask, how are ideas, symbols, cultures transmitted? One cannot deduce the past from the present from the past, nor can one, as is rather too common these days, transpose valid insights into how an individual is shaped by his or her past, and particularly their childhood, the history of collective entities like nations or peoples. I think there's far too much psychological transposition from individual psychology to collective psychology. I would indeed in this context suggest a controversial thesis, except that I happen to hold it, concerning the longevity of nations. Since these ideas need to be reproduced, and since they can only be reproduced by living people, I would argue that no nation is older than the oldest living person who claims membership of it. That's a highly controversial position, but it's one that I would hold. If an identity or a language or an animosity hold today, it's because it is in the interests of living people to continue it. When, as happened to me long ago in a rather badly organized queue at an airport, a Frenchman turned to me and said, "Mais vous Anglais, vous avez brûlé Jeanne d'Arc," he said. "You English, you burnt Joan of Arc." And for him, that was the basic problem in this airline queue. He was telling me something about airline ticket queues, not about Joan of Arc and the Maid of Orleans. If people at football matches shout abuse at each other, it's for contemporary, not for historical reasons. If there are historic memories, or alleged memories, in the row of a BSE, or the intrusions of the English language into French, or of American into English, the same applies. I'm very struck by what is in many ways a minor but interesting symbolic development in this island, or part of it in recent years, which is the emergence in the middle of April, particularly in the more, less rapidly changing, shall we put it, parts of the home counties, of the red flag of St. George. But it was worth noting that in the last general election, which was held, as we remember, on May the 1st, both Mr. Blair and Mr. Major wore this in their lapel around the date of April the 23rd, which is, of course, St. George's Day. Now, why has this become important? Well, in one sense, you might say it always was there in the flag of the Union Jack along with the Welsh and Scottish flags, but why has it become more prominent recently? Some people say it's because of the greater importance of football in defining public identity, and that may be true. Although, interestingly, the symbol of the English team in the World Cup was the very British chicken vindaloo, which was a curious thing. Or the vindaloo itself, of course, being a Goan dish derived from the Portuguese for welcome, bem-venido, or something. So a curious kind of transnational creation. But one reason for the St. George's flag is said to be football. A second, particularly in, I don't know why they're called the home counties, but they are like sort of public schools and private income, teacher availability day, one of those strange English terms. A second is dislike of Brussels. A third, of course, of which we're going to hear more because Mr. Livingstone's going to start raising this as a financial and fiscal issue because of English resentment about subsidizing Scotland, and again up in Newcastle and places it has that significance. But all I'm saying is a number of contemporary issues, be it football, Brussels, Scottish devolution, have stirred up this concern with Englishness and the flag of St. George. Now, who was St. George? Well, nobody really knows. He certainly had never heard of England. He died in the 4th century in Egypt. He's also the patron saint of Greece, I think, Finland, Norway, a number of other countries, and all power to him. But in other words, we're not going to understand the St. George's lapel or flag by asking any question about the past. We're going to ask some questions about Britain in the last 10 years. In the Middle East, much is made of the past and of the ancient animosities of peoples. But I think if you look more closely, you can see these are revived or selected for present purposes. For example, during the Iran-Iraq War, Saddam Hussein used to refer to Ayatollah Khomeini of Iran as a Magus, a Persian or Zoroastrian priest. And he called his own battle against Iran the Qadisiyya, the battle in the 7th century when the Arab Islamic armies defeated Iran. And Khomeini used to refer to Saddam as a Yazid, the name of the caliph, the Sunni caliph, who killed the founder of Shiism, Hussein bin Ali. Both, interestingly, used to accuse each other, Khomeini and Saddam, used to accuse each other of going to Tel Aviv every week to get their instructions, which is something I rather doubt. But interesting variations of diatribe can be noted elsewhere in the Middle East. For example, in the Mediterranean Arab countries, which were once known by this term, the Levant, Western aggressors are often referred to as crusaders or Salibiyin. But this is not the term that Saddam uses when denouncing the US and its allies, for example, during their attack on Iraq in Desert Storm in 1991. Then he denounced them not as Salibiyin, people who came from the West, but as Mongols, people who came from the East. And George Bush was portrayed as Hulagu, the Mongol conqueror who sacked Baghdad in 1258. This use of the past, this for contemporary purposes, and this selection of a past depends on precisely the mechanisms of contemporary interest and contemporary reproduction that Barrington Moore identifies. In Britain, it may take a relatively harmless form, as indeed the flag of St. George does. History textbooks are sites of battle. There is less dispute over the names of streets and pubs, all of which seem to be called after the Duke of this and the Duchess of that, rather than after Tom Paine or Oliver Cromwell or anywhere else. The Sun newspaper has just published a book which it hopes to place in every school in Britain, which invents chauvinist headlines for all of British history, for example, celebrating Richard I's conquest of Jerusalem and so on. But in the Balkans, on the other hand, such use of the past is not comic. It may take a very lethal form, with, of course, not just books and popular culture, but television and music denouncing other communities and transmitting a history of hatred and paranoia, which ensures that the same thing happens all over again. Barrington Moore invites us to examine how a particular past is constructed. Now, of course, the answer of nationalists, as of those who believe in religions and essentialists, is that there is one past, one culture, one tradition, one true this, one true that. The word authentic frequently arises. And the argument then becomes what the true identity or tradition is. But we know very well that this is not how things are. On the one hand, the past is not one text or one message, but many. If I can use a favorite idiom from gastronomy, the texts of politics and of the great religions are not fixed price menus, but they're a la carte. You choose what you want from the past, and that choice is dictated by contemporary interests and concerns, not by what is given in the past. If you want to use your national traditions or religion to prove the validity of monarchy, you can do so. If you want to use it to prove republicanism, you can do so. Every country in the world has a national assembly or a parliament of some kind. They call it by traditional names. In the Middle East, the Majlis or the Shura or the Knesset or whatever it is. But it's not these traditional institutions and names which define the present. They simply ransack the past to find what they want. In Islam, there's been a fascinating debate about what form of political social organization is appropriate to Islam. Now, 20 years ago, the debate was between capitalism and communism. So those who believed in capitalism found the appropriate quotes from the Quran and from the sayings of the Prophet to prove it. The favorite one was very straightforward, a saying attributed to the Prophet, whoever takes your house, kill him. And that was used as the basis for private property and for the justification of capitalism. On the other hand, the socialists found a quote in the Quran which says that among the people, there are three things which are shared, water, grass, and fire. They said, aha, water, grass, and fire, in a primitive nomadic society, these are the means of production, these show they should be shared. Then along came others who said, no, wait a minute, capitalism, socialism, that's not true Islam. True Islam is feudalism. We had feudalism, the Europeans had feudalism, so we should have feudalism. And then finally some sheikh in Tunis, not long ago, said, forget all this, the true form of true social organization is slavery, because there's a lot in the Quran about slavery. Now, the point is, you can find what you want in each of these contexts in this a la carte way. We can see this very clearly in the Arab-Israeli context today, in which we can see a use to which holy texts are put. Amongst Palestinian Muslims, those who favor a peace with Israel cite the example of the truce, or the hudna, signed by the Prophet with infidels. Those against cite verses of the Quran enjoining struggle against the infidel. On the Jewish side, the argument has revolved around the question of whether a Jewish state can give away Jewish land. Those against territorial concessions say you cannot. Those in favor cite the story whereby King David gave away some land to the king of Tyre. Of course, in every issue, whether it's territorial questions like that, whether it's the question of social organization or gender relations and the position of women, a similar variety of interpretations is possible. In Hinduism recently, there has been a strong attempt to codify not just the holy books and have one holy book when there used to be many, to have gods, and particularly one god who is of clear gender, because in the past there was a combination of masculine and feminine in many Hindu gods, but also, most importantly, for any modern religion, to have a clear ideology for subordinating women. There was an interesting interview on the television not long ago with the organizer of one of the Ram festivals, Ram now being the kind of substitute for a monotheistic god in Hinduism, the nearest they're going to have. And he said, there are four kinds of women. And the interviewer said, well, how do you say that? He said, well, first of all, there's the ordinary woman. Then there's the super, the divine woman, close to goddesses. Then thirdly, there's the fallen woman. So the interviewer said, well, what can be lower than the fallen woman? The educated woman, he said. That's lower than the fallen woman. And you could say that in every religion, if you wanted to, without appropriate quotations from texts. In the former Soviet republics, just to give you one more example, there is the question, indeed, in all countries of producing the heroes that justify the national tradition. And I've always been struck by the fate of the Ukrainians because, of course, the most famous Ukrainian of all is the one they never want to mention, somebody born in the Ukraine, somebody who spoke Ukrainian, but he's Leon Trotsky, who was a Bolshevik, who was Jewish, who is an internationalist, and certainly doesn't fit into much of present Ukrainian nationalism. In England, we have the case of Tom Paine, after whom no pubs, I think, are named in this country. And if you go to his home village of Thetford in Norfolk, you'll find a statue there, but it was erected by American servicemen stationed near there in the Second World War, and not by the local people. And indeed, if you go to the local tourist office, they'll tell you that he did nothing for Thetford and therefore shouldn't be remembered. This critical attitude to what are presented as the givens of the past may help us to set in context something else that is also seen as particularly specific to the modern or postmodern condition, something that defines the break between the present and the past, and that is the movement of ideas and symbols across frontiers. I think here we see one of the examples of a tendency to short-sightedness in contemporary discussion of culture and globalizations. Certainly, modern communications permit of a rapid and voluminous transmission of cultural material around the world. But it is the rapidity and volume which are new, not, I would argue, the phenomenon itself. If we take the great religions, they spread, if not with the speed of a computer, then often with the speed of a horse or of a ship. The ideas of Christ and Muhammad and of countless preachers, saints, and heretics were transmitted around the Mediterranean world. When Martin Luther fixed his 95 theses denouncing the sale of indulgences to the door of All Saints Church in Wittenberg on the 31st of October, 1517, CNN was not there to record the moment. But within a few years, his ideas had contributed to a major upheaval throughout Europe. In the 18th century, the ideas of European political thought informed debate in the Americas, just as American radicalism affected Europe. I think this question of redefining the historical space and the historical trend also applies to what is taken to be another defining feature of contemporary cultural and political analysis, that of hybridity. The assumption here is that hitherto identities were unitary and discrete, and it's only in modern times that this was changed. But hybridity is recurrent throughout history. With no disrespect to the faithful, all great religions are hybrids, borrowing themes, symbols, dates, and forms of ceremonial from their multiple predecessors and trying to take them over, and once established, and this is also very important, imitating their opponents. If you look at the history of, say, iconoclasm, breaking of images, or of holy war in Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, what you see is one of borrowing and imitation and rivalry, the one from the other. The same applies to language. A Dutch philologist once said to me, "You English, you don't have a language. English is a bastard creation of German and French." Well, that's fine. He's right, but that's fine. Because this bastard creation has been the vehicle for great human creativity and amusement, and I suspect will continue so for a long time. Now, in politics, I would argue a similar fluidity and hybridity has also long prevailed, and we would be mistaken to apply in politics the picture of cultural blocs and of their effect on international relations, which is invalid in the field of culture. Let us look at the pattern of interstate relations in modern times and in earlier centuries, because I think here we will see they do not follow cultural or civilizational boundaries. The most obvious example here is the Ottoman Empire. The Ottoman Empire is conventionally presented as the great non-European other against which Europe defined itself. In the Austria of today, of course, Jörg Haider has chosen as one of his heroes Count von Stahr-Hamburg, who defended Vienna against the Turkish siege in 1683. But the fact is, the Ottoman Empire was not engaged in constant conflict with European powers. It allied with France and Britain against Russia, for example, in the Crimean War of the 1850s. It then allied with Germany and Austria against France and Britain in World War I. In the 20th century, indeed, the most ferocious wars have been between states and peoples of the same cultural bloc, between France, Britain, Russia and Germany in Europe, between China and Japan in the Far East, between Iran and Iraq in the Middle East. If anything, it's not what Freud called the narcissism of small differences which has determined international relations or intercivilization or intercultural conflict, but a narcissism of large differences, but not about culture at all, but rather about material interest, about territory, about strategy, which have constituted the international situation. Now, beneath this image of international relations as determined by cultural conflict in the past or in the present, there lie two other very important assumptions. One, already suggested in the quotation from Barrington Moore, is that the past determines the present. And here I want to stress, it may influence the present. I'm quite willing in particular cases or in general to hear it. But we cannot resolve this question by engaging in broad historical speculation about the return of the past or the importance of the primordial or what the substratum affects the present, how the substratum affects the present, and so forth. It's far too easy to get into this, as I say, fault line babble, but it's very much more difficult to prove it. It may, but I think the onus should be on those who claim it rather than those who claim the opposite. Secondly, there is an assumption in this ascription of culture to international relations as a causative factor. There is an assumption, it's very present in Huntingdon, that in some way, confrontation, conflict, the identification of an enemy, are not just recurrent, but somehow essential features of political and social life. This may take the form of Toynbee's challenge and response. It may take the form of contemporary analysis of the role of the other in the form of national and broader civilizational identity. And here again, what is an obvious psychological factor in the development of any child, which is the distinction between what it is and it is transposed through some rather loose social psychology into the history of nations, where I think it's much less certain. And in this context, not just psychological work, but anthropological work on boundaries and identity, and sociobiological work on animal behavior and genetic selection often play their part. And in this neo-Darwinian age that we live in, it's easy to go along this track. Now, there's obviously some truth in the claim, rooted in history, of confrontation being a source of stimulus to internal change. It's true of individuals who mature through facing tests, and it may be true of societies. But I'd argue it's a contingent claim. It's not necessarily so. The opposite may be true. If we're going to base it on analogies with individuals, then individuals may be stimulated by external challenge, but they may be overwhelmed. They may be traumatized by the challenges they face. And on the other hand, they may be encouraged to grow through love, through support, through cooperation, as may states, societies, and nations. Societies may be stimulated through challenge, but they may also be inhibited by external confrontations. After all, during the Cold War, people endlessly argued that the arms race and the confrontations on East and West deform the societies involved. Moreover, if we look at many aspects of human life, individual and social, growth isn't stimulated by the external at all. It's endogenously stimulated. It's obviously true for example, the physical growth of individuals and many aspects of the growth of individuals' mentality as well. And if we look at states and nations, the same may apply. I'm not saying it necessarily does. But to take one of the most important and formative processes of modern history, the conquest of the Americas, an extraordinary, sometimes brutal, but also creative achievement of the past half millennium. This was not carried out against any external enemy. The drive from Europe was not against an external enemy. It involved the destruction of the civilizations that were there. But the drive was an endogenous one. It was an external expansion. The native inhabitants of America did not threaten Europe, nor did those in Asia and Africa and elsewhere against whom European expansion was conducted. Similarly, I think one can argue, and I think recent economic history goes in this direction, the Industrial Revolution, too, was only in part, probably in smaller part than people previously thought, a result of external pressure or interstate competition. It's more a result of endogenous growth and opportunity within states themselves, against whom, indeed, is the current technological transformation in the field of communications directed. When we come to the contemporary post-1980 world, we hear much that is based upon this assumption of challenge and the need for an enemy. We hear in particular that with the disappearance of the communist threat, another threat has to be invented, and this is done on cultural lines. Here, indeed, is the force of Huntington's question, which I've already raised. If not culture, then what? And, of course, the obvious candidate for this is some non-European other, be it China or Islam. And Islam, in much of the discussion, is the favored candidate. But not only is the underlying historical assumption questionable that somehow the West needs an enemy and that needs a confrontation, it's also questionable whether in any real sense you can compare communism to Islam. Communism was a threat, ideologically, militarily. It won over millions of people in the West, whereas the Islamic states are not a military threat. They're certainly not an economic threat. They bank all their money in the West. They do not propose an alternative system of economy to that which prevails in the West, and they are, of course, divided among themselves into 54, no less, separate states. So the reality is not one of confrontation with Islam, but nor indeed do the historic premises of the analogy with communism or the necessity for a threat really apply. I want to take a moment now to look at another dimension of this, not so much relations between states as to look at ideologies of defiance or ideologies that reject what are called Western values. In the course of the 20th century, many challenges have been made to the domination of the Western powers, some in the language of nationalism, some in the language of Marxism, but some in what would be termed distinct cultural terms. In other words, ones which argue that we have a distinct culture with which to reject, critique and reject the West and construct an alternative society. That of Gandhi in Hindu politics and ethics, that of Khomeini in Islamic terms, for example. But I think one has to question, and here I think we're a question of raising the threshold and actually looking at the case studies and studying what's going on, not just making broad change claims about alterity or the other or whatever it might be, question how far these discourses are really distinct. Because if you look at the central claims they're making, they're about the domination of the world by rich and powerful states, they're about the denial of cultural diversity, they're about the rejection of indigenous people's interests, and so forth. If we take the most violent arguments against Western domination and the justification of revolt against them, the language of Mao Zedong or of Franz Fanon or of Che Guevara, they talked in a radical language, but it was one which articulated many themes that were common to the radical Western tradition. When Ho Chi Minh proclaimed Vietnamese independence in 1945, he quoted from the American Declaration of Independence. When Fidel Castro made his famous speech from the dock in 1953, history will absolve me, he gave a long account of the right to rebel and of the moral justifications of the right to rebel based on medieval European and modern Latin American thought. And even those who appear to be more different may not be that different. Gandhi shaped a Hindu tradition to meet his particular modern needs, but the pacifism he espoused was greatly influenced by Tolstoy, just as his goal of autonomous village-based development drew on modular international themes of autarky. Moreover, Gandhi did not represent Hinduism. He represented a particular interpretation of Hinduism, because in contrast to his pacifism and his espousal of nonviolence, you can have, as you certainly now do have in India, an equally militant interpretation, an equally valid militant interpretation of Hindu based on all the warrior gods who struggle against the enemies of the faith. If you look at Khomeini, it's easy to say, oh, this is a non-Western voice and this is culturally different. And he certainly used Quranic terms in his vocabulary. But again, Khomeini denounced imperialism. I mean, he called it arrogance. Estekbari Jahani, world arrogance, he called it. But he meant imperialism. He called for the revolt of the peoples. He called for revolution, not a term that existed in the Quran. And indeed, he celebrated May Day as Islamic Workers' Day and praised the working class for their contribution to Islam and even asserted that God, Allah himself, was a worker. The sweat of the laborer is equal to the prayers of the faithful, he said, quoting the Prophet, indeed. Khomeini, like all Islamists, kept his eye firmly on what were the central goals of his movement: challenging external powers, getting control of the state, and keeping it. And that was a logic of a thoroughly modern kind. An interesting example of this is a visit paid to London recently by the foreign minister of the Islamic Republic of Iran, Dr. Kamal Kharazi, the first official visit by an Iranian minister to London since the revolution of 1979. And being a student of the foreign policies of revolutions and of the foreign policy of Iran, it was, as the Americans say, a two for one for me to go and hear him speak at the Royal Institute of International Affairs. Now, Dr. Kharazi played what I thought was a cruel intellectual trick on his audience, because, a nice one, though, one I liked. He began by saying that the world was indeed divided by culture. But he then went on to argue that these two cultures were as follows. There was a culture of exclusion and a culture of inclusion. The culture of exclusion was marked by centralization, authoritarianism, and the evasion of law, particularly international law, by discrimination and injustice, by accumulation of wealth, and by militarism. We all knew who he meant. That of inclusion, the culture of inclusion, was marked by cultural pluralism and diversity, by democracy, by freedom, participation, justice, tolerance, and collective security. The culture of inclusion, he asserted, is the culture of free-minded, justice-seeking, and peaceful persons. The new world order must be based on inclusion, so that our world will manage to pass through the remaining traces of the culture of obscurantism and move towards the culture of a new enlightenment. This is the foreign minister of Iran speaking. And we must put our global house in order on the basis of the rule of law and equity. He quoted from John Locke, as did Fidel Castro, indeed, in 1953, as well as from Iranian President Khatami, who's called for a dialogue of civilizations. Dr. Kharazi supported a whole range of modern political goals. Well, they were all there: civil society, human rights, good governance, confidence building. He recognized and welcomed the diversity of human rules and religions in the world. In the whole of his speech, there was only one reference to Islam, when he called for the need to promote good governance on the basis of Islamic teachings. But notice the word teachings is very loose. He didn't say texts or faith or anything else. This was a voice like the others: Mao, Fanon, Khomeini, Gandhi. This was a voice that was critical of the West and based on a particular reading of Islamic and Iranian values, but was at the same time part of a broader universal, anti-hegemonic, and human vision. I think there was little to comfort cultural relativists or Professor Samuel Huntington in what he said. Islamic radicals elsewhere, who are the epitome of cultural diversity today, assert that the answer to their problem lies in tradition and in holy texts. But this too is, on closer examination, not entirely the case. It's certainly the case that culturally specific texts are invoked, but the uses to which they are put in regard to law or political model or the economy are very much contemporary ones and reflect contemporary challenges and choices. The legal basis of all this, Sharia law, is not a divinely given corpus at all, but is rather a body of interpretation and case law with varying schools of the kind you find everywhere built up over centuries. Only 80 of the 6,000 verses or ayats of the Quran are concerned with legal matters, most of these with issues of personal or family dispute. The interpretation, the selection, the implementation of this law are more contingent, human, contemporary than any current slogans would suggest. So much for the analytic side of this issue. The issue of culture, as I suggested at the beginning, also raises considerable ethical debate, not least with regard to the claims made in its name. And here, two arguments prevalent in contemporary debate merit, I think, particular attention. One is one that I would have found it inconceivable when I was a student that anybody should be discussing in universities, but they are, which is that tradition as such conveys moral authority, and that which is inherited from the past, from ancestors and a community into which one is born, should be followed or obeyed. To say that something is traditional, is authentic, is derived from the past, is in itself, it seems, to convey legitimacy on it. A second related claim is that membership of such a community, and indeed the claims of communities, and in international relations terms of nations, claims as enunciated by their representatives are supreme and allow of no overriding judgment and contradiction. Both of these are widespread and, I think, questionable arguments. The claim that the past conveys legitimacy on the present for individuals and communities would have shocked our liberal and Enlightenment predecessors. For them, and for all those who over the past century or more have striven for modernity in traditional society, the past, even if you could agree what it was, the past is something to be rejected, a shackle to be cast off, a drag on progress towards a better world. Heritage is something to be criticized, tradition something to be defied. Those in Europe who renounced the Catholic Church, those in India who rejected the claims of Brahmins, those in China who denounced foot binding and pigtails, those in the Jewish tradition who sought to cast off the word of the shtetl and the authority of the rabbi, those in the Islamic world who called for the freeing of women from veiling and inequality, all espouse such a modernist view. But today we seem to have turned full circle, or partly circle, when all that is in the past is accepted, and if you want to have a modern critical idea, you have to disguise it as something coming from the past. Now, leaving aside the sociological question, the Barrington-Moore question, which is how do you define the past and which bit of the text do you apply? And of course, in the end of the day, it's authority, very often patriarchal authority, which answers that, not any given learning. The very acceptance of the past as being morally authoritative is something which is, as I say, debatable. The right of individuals to question their tradition and their community should, I think, be recognized and must be linked, as it too rarely is, to a recognition that what are presented as homogeneous or consensual communities rarely are. I think there is a sort of naivety about the term community, as if people know exactly what they mean. Now, I remember 2 or 3 years ago being in the Midwest and going with my family to visit the Amish, and we saw them going in their little trucks, their little horse-drawn buggies along in their 18th century clothes and speaking this strange Schwitzerdeutsch sort of Swedish, a Swiss-German language. But here was a clearly artificially sustained and maintained community. And I think when North American political theorists talk about community, they kind of think of the Amish. But the Amish, I mean, there are no Amish in big multicultural cities, and culture isn't frozen in that way. And when religious leaders or sundry other patriarchs claim to speak on behalf of their communities, and of course not least on behalf of the women in their communities, we should question to what extent this term has meaning. Now, the dangers of such a deference to tradition are not hard to see. And one striking example is, of course, in regard to gender. While all religions set out to define the appropriate role for women and to subject them to forms of control, this is something which in many ways modern religions and communities are trying to do all the more. And the argument is sometimes phrased in terms of, well, what does the text actually say? Can you interpret the Christian tradition or the Jewish texts or the Islamic texts, whatever it is, to allow of a more modernist or liberal interpretation? And if you're living under the de facto authority of those communities and of those powers, that's the way you've got to argue. But it's not the only point, because the tradition is not only open to interpretation in different ways, it should not be necessary to accept the tradition as having authority at all. And this authority of tradition and the past, and I repeat, as defined contingently by those with power and with an interest in keeping that power, is even more evident and is equally dangerous in an area that abuts onto international relations, which is that of intercommunal conflict. Here we see claims about territory, about boundaries, holy places, historic sites, place and street names held up as if they were somehow something to be respected or accommodated. From the Gavahi Road in Northern Ireland through Kosovo Field and to the contests of Jerusalem to Ayodhya in India, this pattern of historical legitimation is used to promote claim and conflict. The efforts of well-intentioned mediators go, or often go, into trying to find an accommodation or recognition, or to use a word widely heard these days, respect for the various sensibilities and traditions involved. And this may well be necessary. I mean, respect for tradition of the two communities was central to the Good Friday Agreement in Northern Ireland. But another way this may be to concede too much. What of saying that such claims, far from acquiring greater legitimacy the longer they go back in time, have a receding, discounted validity the further back they go? If people have worshipped or chanted or marched or buried or done whatever they've done for some centuries, isn't that enough? The problem in Northern Ireland is not two conflicting traditions, it's the two traditions themselves. The problem in Jerusalem is not the lack of respect for the three religions, it's too much respect for all of them, and their fatuous and often sanctimonious claims. What does it honestly matter if one holy person of centuries ago was buried or not buried in Ayodhya, when the cost of disputing this leads to the loss of lives and continuing intercommunal tensions? I think that a bit of modernist impatience and skepticism about the truth and ethical validity of communal claims and about tradition would not be in order today. And this brings me to the issue of the claims of community or nation against broader claims and pressures, international ones, and ones involving international obligation. What we see in the contemporary world is a growing divergence between these two forms of discourse, a universalist discourse with regard to rights as embodied in international conventions, and a discourse that denies such universality on the grounds of community identity and, in the international relations sphere, of course, on grounds of sovereignty. Now, three different strands have contributed to this questioning of universality in relations between peoples. One is an anti-imperialist critique of Western domination and Western double standards. One is a postmodernist denial of the possibility of a fixed, rational criteria for judgment, anti-foundationalism, if you like. And the third is a political theory questioning of the bases of rights themselves, a critique which is related to the broader questioning of the Enlightenment and of rationality in law and in ethics. And we don't have to look far to see the implications of all this. In international relations, it takes the forms of attacks on Western or UN criticism of human rights policies by such states as China, Iran, or Russia, or for that matter, of criticism of the death penalty in the United States. It takes criticism in communal relations, it takes the form of resistance to legal and ethical universalism by those who speak for or claim to speak for communities. Now, there is a factual element here, as I've suggested. Do those who claim to speak for peoples and communities really do so, about which one has to remain pretty skeptical? But even if this is so, the traditional and the inherited should be held to account against other international criteria, and for two good reasons. One is simply positive, or positivist, if you like. If states have signed up to international bodies like the UN Charter and all the human rights codes, or some of them, and to international legal codes, they can and should be held accountable for them. And this applies not only to the various UN human rights conventions specifically concerned with rights, but also to the Charter itself. All 185 countries in the world, whatever their cultural or religious heritage, are signatories of the Charter and are committed by dint of that very document itself to respect for basic human rights as well as for basic norms of international behavior. The preamble and Articles 1 and 13 of the Charter commit the signatory states to opposing discrimination on the basis of race, religion, or sex. And of course, all world religions are in contravention of the UN Charter in this regard. More than half a century down the line, we can say that no state in the world has fully met these obligations. And yet, if the states don't like these obligations, in my view, they should leave the United Nations. A second reason for questioning the denial of universality and for questioning the particular ways in which political theorists seek to challenge rights is to be found in the very language used by those who reject criticisms. There are, very obviously, certain moral claims which no state in the world and no community either questions. For all the diversity that we have, nobody questions the right of nations to self-determination, the principle of the sovereignty of states, or the right to economic development. No culture that I'm aware of rejects the principle of self-determination any more than any country I'm aware of wishes to be excluded from the World Cup or not to conform to other non-mandatory but essential elements of global political culture, such as having a national airline, a flag, a capital city, and a national anthem. When we look in more detail at the criticisms made of rights in the international arena, we find underlying the criticisms a logic that is itself universalistic, not particularist. In other words, the degree of diversity and degree of rejection of the universal is much yet less. For example, the challenge of double standards implies of necessity that there are universal standards of consistency and that they should be respected, not defied. If Iraq denounces the West for double standards on Palestine, or the Serbs denounce them for double standards on Turkey, or the Turks raise the question of Chechnya, or if the Kurds raise the question of Kurdistan, or if liberal Arabs question Western silence in Saudi Arabia. This is because these criticisms imply that universal standards are valid and should be implemented. Moreover, if we look, and again, it's a question of reading what is actually said rather than talking about diverse cultures in a sort of vague and woolly way, if we look at the terms in which criticism of human rights is rejected, a similar commitment to universalism is to be identified. I've already given you the gist of the Iranian foreign minister's speech to Chatham House. When China or Iran reject Western criticism, it's not in the name of tradition, of Confucianism or Shiite Islam. Criticism is rejected in the name of what? Of sovereignty, or of the primacy of economic over political rights at various stages of development, or by criticizing imperialism, or by questioning the motives and consistency of those doing the criticizing. They're all agents or something. Again, the debate is framed within a set of universal criteria to which all subscribe, not by reference to a different culture. Indeed, the best form of defense being attacked, it's not surprising that these countries counterattack international criticism by denouncing the West for its failure to meet universal criteria, by neglecting their elderly, or by discriminating against migrants, or by promoting pornography, or by committing war crimes in Kosovo or Iraq or whatever it may be. The differences of emphasis and argument are within a universal language, not to do with differences of culture. The critique that cuts most ice, in my view, is not one based on culture, but based on a critique of hegemony, of domination, of imperialism. One that says that the discourses of rights and their formulation and the responsibility for their current implementation are wholly or largely in the hands of those states which more than many others have power in the contemporary world. And they're also those states which have over recent centuries done more than any others to subjugate, exploit, and control the rest of the world, the Americans, the British, and so forth. This is a powerful charge, and one that is easily available to those who wish to resist outside pressures on good grounds, but also, of course, on bad. But it's not, however, an insuperable one, provided that the history of aggression is acknowledged and provided as much diligent attention is given as possible to overcoming the biases involved in such an origin. The fact that many of the discourses of human rights or of independence or democracy originated in the French or American revolutions is no reason, in my view, for not denying their benefits to others. At the end of the day, we do not live in a perfect world, but one in which we face two broad kinds of choice: the abandonment of universal rights for all their theoretical and practical drawbacks, and with that, a possible descent into greater chaos and barbarism, or one in which, while continuing to be skeptical of definition and implementation, we seek to turn the universality of principle into a universality of practice. For all the differences of language, culture, religion, and history in the world, I have little doubt which of these choices the majority of humanity would prefer. Thank you very much.
Fred Halliday has very kindly agreed to answer some questions. We have a roving microphone in the room, and since the acoustics in this room are extremely poor, once you've been recognized, can you wait for the microphone to arrive before you ask your question?
I was certainly struck by your remark here, which I made a note of, that no nation is older than the oldest member who claims membership of it. I mean, it's sort of something that's like a blow to the head, but very interesting. I mean, enormously liberating. Well, I'm doing a few calculations while you were speaking, and I think you translate that as no nation is older, really, than the lifespan of prime adulthood, let's say 20 to 70, something like that, makes it half a century. Now, you get a half a century wear out, and you could say that no treaty is valid beyond that 50 years, and there just happened to be a couple of treaties coming up for renewal on that basis, that are very popular in some quarters and not so popular in others. The United Nations Convention on Human Rights, I think it's 1951, the Treaty of Rome in 55, was it, or was it 56? And it did strike me that the 1914-18 war, which hinged on the Belgian Treaty, 1834, when it set up, you could say, well, sorry, we're not running that anymore, it's worn out. So, but of course, the thing in favour of tradition, it does act as a break on actions that result in profound discontinuity. Because although it liberates, when you get to my age, you don't want too many profound changes in the interval between...
Not much difference between you and me, is there?
Hmm?
There's not much difference between you.
Well, I think it's rather a lot, actually.
I think it's... When people wish to justify the claims of their community, I mean, nation and religion are two obvious examples, and also the undoubted fact that they feel very strongly about them, they feel part of them, they associate with them, they feel indignant that their rights are done down, they always try and give a kind of both a historical depth and also necessity to these communities. I mean, God ordaining it would be an obvious example for religion and nation. But if you think about it, we're all part of communities that we feel quite strongly about, which you couldn't possibly claim this of. I mean, lots of people support sports, the football teams and so on. Now, clearly, support of a football team is not given by God or by birth. I mean, it's entirely up to your choice, but it doesn't stop people feeling very strongly about it. Secondly, we're members of families, but I mean, the fact that we were conceived and born is obviously a result of accident of one kind or another. Given all the other, but that doesn't, the fact that it was so accidental doesn't mean you don't feel strongly about membership of that particular family. Some people feel strongly about their universities or the streets they live in or the cities they live in or whatever it may be. So I think one can detach what are two obvious facts, is a strong sense of membership and secondly a strong sense of affect from the giving it this enormous historical depth or giving it some fatalistic or preordained character. When I say that no nation is older than the oldest person who claims membership of it, what I mean is that these things have to be reproduced, and if they're not reproduced in the feelings of people and in the lives of people, they will die. If they go on being reproduced, then obviously by people, they will there will be a certain continuity there. As for treaties, the same would apply. I mean, they either come up for renewal in the way in which they're written, and they'll be renewed if people in a Barrington-Moorean way wish to renew them. Or even if they don't, they will fall into disarray or into disuse because people no longer respect them, and that is, again, because the interest and the commitment is not there. So I'm not saying that nations will disappear. There won't be continuity of people claiming to be English or French or Chinese, or the treaties won't continue, but the real point is, it's a common sense point, but I think it hits at the argument of determination of the past. People have got to go on believing and sustaining it. They've got to maintain it, like they've got to maintain buildings or democracy or whatever it might be.
Perhaps I can ask my question. Is there a relationship between the homogenization of cultures that occurs as a result of globalization and the kind of return to rather primitive forms of identity proclamation and nationalism? Or are these two things just happening simultaneously and we making a causal connection? Have they always been present?
I suspect that if one wanted to ask the have they always been present question, one should look at the cultural history of previous analogous cases, of which domination by empires would be an obvious example. How did people in countries which were dominated by culturally, but also militarily and political powers react? And there would no doubt have been some combination of the two. But I would query the first point, and obviously this goes to the heart of last week's lecture as well, the question of America and its influence. How homogeneous is global culture? In an obvious sense, as McDonald's and the CNN and all these things. But if you look at the United States itself, there's a huge degree of cultural change and increasing diversity in lots of ways, and rediscovery of traditions and gastronomies and who knows what else, and for no doubt for contemporary reasons. So in what is supposed to be the heartland of homogeneity, there isn't homogeneity in some ways. Secondly, if we went back in the Middle Ages and wandered around, wouldn't we find certain kinds of religious homogeneity and certainly homogeneity of the culture of the elite, which may not be there? I'm not sure to what extent the world is more homogeneous now than it was in cultural terms, and you'd have to argue about your indices. Is it language? Is it food? Is it dress? Is it whatever it might be? And as for what is happening in the world today in terms of the relationship between the pressures of homogenization and the return to diversity, as I'd prefer to see it, I think some of it is a reaction to homogeneity or just to change. I mean, whether it's more people going to university or rapidity of information or changes in the labor market or whatever. But some of it is actually taking the possibilities which modern technology gives for diversity and running with it. I mean, just look at local radios around Europe using local dialects and indigenous language. I mean, the Finns, what language, I mean, it's a lovely example. What language does Finnish radio do its international broadcasts in? In Latin, because there are more people in Europe who understand Latin than understand Finnish, so they just broadcast in Latin. There are 15 million people in Europe who can understand the news in Latin, and they Finn. So this is, I mean, this is one small, nice example, and they're not claiming this is tradition. But I think that the possibilities which the internet provides, which local radio provides, and many other things provide, changes in food and so forth, dancing, all these things, music, within the changing world, for actually for diversity, some of it recuperating the past, some not, is also an important aspect of the story. The idea we're all going to end up speaking one language and being the same, I think, is highly doubtful.
Gentleman in the third row.
You spoke about the Declaration of Human Rights. There have been some attempts to join a Declaration of Human Responsibilities to a Declaration of Human Rights. Have you any comments on that?
No, it's a commonplace, but I think a perfectly valid one, of much contemporary political and social thoughts, that rights and responsibilities go together. And this is, without trespassing on the terrain of others, far be it, but this is one of the themes on which I think those who propound something called the Third Way in its English version also make. I was very struck years ago by an example of this. A woman I knew, English woman, lived in Cuba for 20 years, and she came back to England. I said, what's it like coming back to Thatcher's Britain after being in Fidel's Cuba for 20 years? And she said, well, in some ways it's quite similar, she said, because Thatcher and Fidel both believed that you should keep the street in front of your house clean. It's your job, your responsibility, not the municipality, not the state. I mean, that was perhaps not very serious, but nevertheless striking in index of where left and right sometimes share views on these things. But I think that the issue of responsibilities is also one which has very strong international dimensions. And nowhere, I mean, traditionally, you know, the last 25 years, an audience of this kind, you'd probably think, certainly 20 years ago, you'd have thought, first of all, of it in the economic field, of foreign aid and the commitment to pushing up foreign aid to 0.7% of GDP and all the things which the Brandt Report called for and never happened. More recently, you'd see it in regard to the issue of rights and how can the state and how can the NGOs and how can indeed even universities play a role, and corporations too, in promoting human rights with all the problems that we know. But of course, in these weeks we're in now, and here we're deeply into the Evan Montiel, as it were, the issue of international responsibilities is the oldest one of all. It's in responsibilities in the field of international peace and security. And I'm not a politician, I've never run for office, so I can say this, but I think that the whole debate in this country over Sierra Leone ignores a simple fact, which is this country enjoys a privilege, which is permanent membership of the UN Security Council, which gives it a veto and many other things, privileges which other states don't have. Article 24 of the UN Charter states very clearly that the permanent members have a special responsibility for the maintenance of international peace and security. And that means that if there is an international political problem which falls within the ambit of the Security Council, which Sierra Leone certainly does, then to say, well, let the Nepalese and the Bengalis and the Nigerians sort this out, but we're not going to go there, which is what's being said in America and being said by people in this country, is simply in contravention of your responsibilities. And again, I mean, all I'd say to people is, okay, If that's what you think, I mean, I'm willing to argue the rights and wrongs of it, but that's what you think, you should get off the Security Council. Stop claiming this privilege because you are not fulfilling the responsibilities you're signed up to. But that's not the way it's posed, and you wouldn't get many votes for saying that. A couple more questions.
Yeah. Hang on.
This is not specifically international relations. I've done a lot of laborious work today, so my mind wandered. One of the things it wandered onto was the fact that the 20th century kind of lacked any really great thinker of global impact. The preceding centuries was littered with them. Is there space in the 21st century for a thinker of global impact? And if there is, what part of the globe is that speaker likely to come from? Europe? The Middle East? Or somewhere?
I had a very... years ago, a charming Hungarian friend, sadly no longer with us, had a way. First of all, he would quote, hundreds of, after a couple of drinks, would quote hundreds of lines of Goethe and Schiller at one and so on in a way that made us all feel greatly humiliated and so on. But he always used one of his tricks. I was more than a trick, but it's a good one. I mean, he used to say, there hasn't been a single original idea since 1914. Not a single original idea since 1914, and not even, and he included architecture, design, the lot in this. I mean, he didn't include the natural sciences, but in humanities, in art, in psychoanalysis, whatever it was, it hasn't been, and of course, being from the Austro-Hungarian world, no doubt he had a particular trades unionist view of this, but that's, and it's a hard one to tackle. Of course, Karl Popper, who was from the same Danubian area, and indeed, like about half of all the people in LSE who've made an international impact, if you think of Gellner and Lakatosh and many others came from that area, Karl Popper would say, and a very good thing too, because these big ideas misled people, and what we need to be is more cautious and more skeptical and so forth. I'm going to try and argue in the last lecture that we don't need new utopias in the sense of new grand schemas or new arguments about the way the world is going, and that we're mercifully rid of those to some degree, but I will equally argue that we need to have and can have a vision of what should be attained and what can be attained, a plausible but remote vision, which if implemented or if even approached would be very, very radical in its effects. The implementation of gender equality worldwide is a very obvious example. The reduction of the global economic inequalities would be another. I mean, these are two things which are not new ideas. They're not revolutionary in the sense of proposing a whole new vision of history, but the world would look a very different place if we got even 50% nearer these two things. In my darker moments, I think they're long durée, but I'd like to think they're conjunctural, if I can put it that way. And so, if that is the case, then I don't think it matters very much. I mean, one of the points I'm trying to make in this lecture, which I'm willing again to hear counter-arguments to, but I prefer to go case by case rather than generalization by generalization, is if you look at those in the 20th century, you have most challenged Western domination. They've done so in the interests of their peoples, they've done so in their own languages, very often in their own cultural terms, but they have been participants in a radical modernity. I mean, the argument is not between the West and the rest, it's between different interpretations of the West, between a conservative and a more radical interpretation. And somebody like Mao or Khomeini or Gandhi, to give three examples, but it would go for the Latin Americans as well, were within that. So I think where they come from is less important than the fact that they will articulate a different view of how the world should be ordered, but in terms of the kind of values which are at least espoused by everybody. I mean, it may well be people will say we should get rid of national independence, or we should get rid of sovereignty, or we should get rid of economic growth. And there are such people, but I think they're largely marginal. But beyond that, I'm not so sure. But I don't believe it will come from somebody saying, let us reject the whole package of the modern world. And because even those who pretend to don't, actually. I mean, Khomeini used to say, one of his great sayings about economics is that economics is for donkeys, he said. Human beings are made for higher things, they're made for prayer. But actually then went on in the next sentence to say we've got to industrialize and distribute wealth to the countryside and introduce running water for villages and all the things which get rid of false foreign consumer needs and so on, all the things which any third world radical would have said. And I think the argument is within the terms set by these universal codes. I mean, if the argument is on double standards, then it's about how consistent can you be on rights or on free trade or whatever it might be. And if we were to get some of the way along this, not very abstract, but in a sense very demanding set of agendas, the world would be a very different place. At the moment, it's going in the opposite direction in lots of ways, lots of ways. And I have not mentioned, or I did mention at the beginning, what is the most visceral issue in all developed countries today, on which nobody that I have read has got a clue, a realistic clue, as opposed to a utopian clue, what is on the issue of migration. Which nobody, I mean, there are lots of people with strong views one way or the other, but I've yet to see someone with a kind of globally responsible and informed strategy on that. Now, where does that, the answer to that question come from? I don't know. I don't have an answer either. We'll get one more.
One more question. Over there at the back, a man in the glasses, please.
How serious were you about the need for modernist impatience with regard to cultural traditions, and how realistic is the transit in the political practice?
Well, I am very impatient. Just as I'm impatient with people who get all worked up about insulting people who've been dead for 1,400 years or more. I mean, I just think it's ridiculous. And one should stop all this sort of reverential, you know, we've got to understand tradition stuff, and say, come on, this is, you know, the world, if this is costing bones and blood and so on, let's put a stop to it. As for what you do on the ground, I leave it to others. And if, you know, you say, would I like to go down the Bagahi Gavahi Road, the Falls Road, or the Shankill and repeat it, the answer is no, I wouldn't, and your company or on my own. So I think I'll leave it there.
I'm sure you'd like to join me in thanking Fred for what was an extremely provocative and very interesting lecture. And I'm sure we're all going to go home and think about how long nations have really lasted. Thank you, Fred.